This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The two midrashim, not directly tied to the meaning of the perek, but just important midrashim in their own rights. The first one is in the right hand column of page 1007, right in the middle of the page, and it goes on the posuk that we learnt of Lo Mas Mireehu Chesed. You've withheld kindness from your friend when Eov accused his friends of not granting him true friendship. Chazal learned that phrase in various different ways, and one of them is right in the middle of that paragraph. You'll see a little lamed gimel there, and then it says, Omru Razal. Our rabbis have said, Chazal have said, Yaakov notal es dino unesano b'seivo. Yaakov, when he was running away from Esau, when he was coming back towards Esau and they were about to meet, he took Dino and he locked her in a box. Omar, he said, Harasha ze eino romo. This Rosho, my brother Esau, he's got big ideas. Shelo yitle eino v'yiro Esau, v'yikach Esau mimeno. He was afraid that Esau would see Dino and would fall in love with her and would want to marry her. And that Yaakov didn't want. Such a shidduch Yaakov didn't want. Rabuna b'shem Rabbi Abba Krem Bad, lo'omelei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lo'mas mere'ehu chesed. Hashem used this very phrase that Eov used so many years later and said, you've deprived your friend of a kindness. At monat chasto min achoch. You have withheld kindness from your brother. If she would have been his Rebbetzin, he wouldn't have gone off the tracks. It's all very well saying Esau was a Rosha. If Dina would have been his wife, he wouldn't have been a Rosha. You didn't want to marry her off to a circumcised person, to your brother Esau. Then by force she'll land up, if not marrying, but at least becoming temporarily and shamedly attached to an uncircumcised man. You didn't want her to have a marriage in an acceptable way, in a normal way. She'll have a marriage in an abnormal way. And that's what it is. The time when Dino went out and she was raped by Chamor ben Shechem. Eilu heiso leiso, heiso megayer eso iso, kishem shegiyer ole iri. If she would have married Esau, she would have converted Esau to Torah, the same as she converted Eiv to Torah. So this is according to a view in Chazal that Eiv lived at the time of Yaakov and married the daughter of Yaakov. Be that part of it as it may, we need to understand a little bit. Why is Yaakov being criticized so much for not wanting his daughter to marry a Rosha? It's all very well saying, yeah, but you know, she married him, he would have come right. That's very nice, but who wants to take that risk? What father would take that risk? What father would allow his daughter to marry a Rosha in the hope that the daughter will bring him around? What kind of risk is that? And Yaakov's criticized for it. There are two dimensions to this, to the understanding of this midrash. The one is that one has to be very careful. Sometimes we become a little bit anti-Semitic, and we look at fellow Yidden and we get despondent sometimes. We don't like the way they behave, we don't like the things they do, we don't like the things they say. And sometimes it gets even worse than that. Sometimes when we're exposed to some fine goyim, we become even more anti-Semitic. You say, oh, the goyim, it's a pleasure. Pleasure doing business with a goyim. I can't tell you how many days I hear people saying that. To have a goyish customer, they buy, they agree, they pay, that's the end of the story. yeah, you deal with a Jew and it's just, you never hear the end of it. Anybody who's in business tells you that. And never, the worst part is that very often I tell you dealing with from Jews is the worst of all. That's a serious problem. But this you often hear. What a pleasure to be dealing with goyims. We're dealing with Jews. And we tend to become quite anti-Semitic. That's all okay. We're not meant to turn a blind eye to the faults of the Jewish community. That's a serious accusation. If people are saying, Jews, never mind Gentiles, if we feel that we prefer doing business with non-Jews than Jews, that's a serious problem that needs to be addressed. We can't pretend it's not so. If we find that non-Jews are raising their children in a way that is finer, that is more noble than Jews are, people say, a Jewish kid, you can see it a mile away, look at that, spoiled to bits. Nice Jewish kid, look how he behaves, says, good morning, madam, good afternoon, sir. Respects his teachers, dresses nicely. Well, it's fine, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with those criticisms, and they need to be addressed, they're very serious. But we've got to realize that at the end of the day, if we find ourselves in real tzoros, we're going to go to Jews, we're not going to go to Goyim for help. We've got to realize at the end of the day, you might be looking at a Yid who is not what you would like him to be. He doesn't behave the way you would like him to be. He doesn't talk the way you would like him to be. He doesn't do business the way you would like him to be. But there's one thing about him. It's not veneer. That's how he is. That's how he is. You're seeing the best and the worst of him. There's no cover-up. With a goyim, it's not required. There isn't a non-Jewish culture that requires a person to change his midos. All that is required in non-Jewish culture is for a person to modify his behavior, his conduct. So there are rules and regulations of the correct way to behave in different situations. And we look at that, and that's what we're admiring. Look how nicely he behaves. We're admiring his behavior. We're admiring the way he looks. We're admiring the way he functions. But that's not necessarily the way he is. So you'll say, what difference does it make? What do I care how he is? If that's how he functions, I prefer doing business with him than doing business with him. That's fine, that's okay. But when the pressure's on, you notice it. It's happened to me that I've been entertained by non-Jews quite recently, in fact, one example of it. Very fine. Unbelievably fine. And couldn't stop talking about how wonderful the Jewish people are and this, all sorts of things. And during the course of the entertainment, after a drink or two, anti-Semitic statements coming out and then trying to catch themselves, but just a little too late, and feeling terribly embarrassed. But not once, several times. One or two drinks and already they start coming out. And all of a sudden you see the veneer breaks down, it's gone. And you see who they really are. We can't understand what the Holocaust was all about and why and what we were. Maybe one day we'll understand. But we can try and learn from it. Learning from something doesn't mean you understand it in its totality. It means that you're able to draw certain lessons from it. And there's no doubt in my mind that the Ribbono Shel Olam chose the most civilized of all nations for it to happen with. To teach us one lesson and only one lesson. If the Germans could do it, anybody could do it. People like looking at it now and they like saying, the Germans, they're the worst of the whole lot. They're not. The Germans are the best of the whole lot. By far the best of the whole lot. The Germans are much better than the British. Much better than the Americans. Much better than the French. They're much more cultured. Look at their culture. Look at their civilization. Look at their art. Look at their literature. Look at their philosophies. They're far ahead of any other nation in terms of civilization. It's not, that could happen in Germany. One can understand it happening in Germany. The way we need to look at it is, if it could happen in Germany, it could happen anywhere. Because the last place in the world, if you would have asked a Jew in the 1920s, imagine a Holocaust and describe to him a Hitler scenario, the possibility of it happening, I have absolutely no doubt that any Jew in the world at that time would have put Germany at the bottom of the list. It could happen in France, it could happen in Italy, it could happen in the Muslim countries, it could happen in the African countries, it could happen in the South American Catholic countries, it could happen in North America. And at the very bottom they would say, maybe even Germany. Maybe. Can't imagine it, but maybe. Germany was, and in a sense is, by far the most civilized of civilizations. And look what happened. The degeneracy wasn't just that they killed a few people, a total removal of all humanity, a total descent into absolute barbarism. I was listening to a CD in one of these music cassettes, and it was an interesting one. It was of a composer, of a conductor that hasn't been recorded much, and I found a few recordings and I put them onto CD. This particular one, and it was magnificent. This was absolutely magnificent. It was a Bruckner symphony, played like I've never heard Bruckner played before. You could cry. It was unbelievable. Every note, every bar, it was so beautiful. And the recording was done in 1942 in Berlin. And I sat there thinking to myself, there in 1942, these very sounds that I'm listening to, this unbelievable music was being played in the concert hall in Berlin, while down the road they were stacking Jewish bodies into the gas chambers and Jewish people into the gas chambers and bodies into the ovens. Same people. The same people. What is it? The one is a veneer and the one is the real thing. That you don't find with Jews. That never happens with Jews. When Jews go to war, even irreligious, totally distant Jews, they don't become barbarians. They don't rape. They don't plunder. They behave in war the same way as they behave in peace. They behave a bit better in war than they behave in peace. The Jew that you see doing business is the way you'll see him under any circumstances. He won't be any different. That's him. And you see him warts and all. And maybe that's why there are all these anti-Semitic jokes, because we're not so good at veneer. So you see all these characteristics, you see all these negative characteristics of the Jew. Because there's nothing covered up, that's the way we are. And when a Jew does change himself, when a Jew does develop himself, when a Jew does move forward, it's not the veneer. He moves forward with everything. It's his real heart and soul that moves forward. And so we have this very double sort of relationship with Jews and Gentiles. And we need to have that double relationship. We need to see both sides of it. We cannot pretend that Jewish behavior today, South Africa and elsewhere, is as good as non-Jewish behavior. If we start pretending that, we'll never get ourselves right. We have to acknowledge it's not. The non-Jewish children are being raised in many, many ways, more effectively in terms of conduct, in terms of derech eretz, just in terms of, that's the difference between derech eretz and midas. Derech eretz is just how you relate to people. Whether you feel that way or you don't, that's derech eretz. Midas is how you really feel. There's a difference. Derech eretz is universal. Everybody has to have derech eretz, because that's the way people can get on with each other. And when it comes to derech eretz, regrettably, the non-Jews are better than we are at the moment. It shouldn't be that way. It's very, very regrettable. It is that way. And we can't pretend it's not that way. On the other hand, we need to recognize that derech eretz is only derech eretz. That's as far as it goes. It's very fine derech eretz, very important derech eretz, and very, very valuable. But it's not the heart and soul of the matter, it's not the heart and soul of the person. But the heart and soul of the person is different. How different is he? We don't secularize these types, do we? We don't secularize these types. An African is a goy, and a British lord is a goy. There is far less difference between the British lord and the African from the Transkei than there is between the British lord and an ordinary Jewish peasant. That's what we have to remember. The difference between the lord and an African from the Transkei is a difference in veneer. The difference between the lord and the Jewish peasant is a difference in neshama. A non-Jew sometimes gets to the point where he wants to change the Shomer, where he wants to change values, not just external things. That's the point at which his neshama craves for conversion. That's the point at which he says, I want to become Jewish. That's what becoming Jewish means. I need mitzvahs. I need exercises. I need to change inside. I'm not satisfied anymore with veneer only. I want to change inside. That's what Geirus is. That's when a person comes, tachas kanfei hashchina. That's when a neshama, a non-Jewish neshama says, veneer is not for me. I need the Torah process to affect me deeply inside. That's where he makes that shift. But until that shift is made, if he's satisfied with that veneer, and don't forget, and what I'm saying very well considered, that British lord is no more civilized than the Germans were. No more civilized. And if the Germans could do what they did, the British lord could do it too. I'm not sure that the African and the Trans guy would do it so easily. Maybe too. But certainly not much of a muchness. That's what one has to understand. But at the end of the day, we're closer to our own brothers, no matter how critical we are of them, no matter how angry we get with them sometimes, no matter how upset we get, and justifiably. But at the end of the day, they're our mishpacha. And at that time, Yaakov's only mishpacha was Esau. Esav was soft called soft. At the end of the day, Esav was a son of Yitzchak. Esav was a grandson of Avraham Avinu. And Yaakov didn't like Esav one little bit. But he's criticized for not recognizing the potential in Esav. The potential in Esav as a Yid, as a potential Yid, as a Ben Avraham, as a Ben Yitzchak. The potential is as great as the potential in Yaakov was. And Chazal say, with a good wife, he would have become a tzaddik. That's the one criticism that's given against Yaakov. The other angle of this criticism is that deep down in Yaakov's subconscious, there seems to have been more of a desire to withhold her from Esau than to protect her from Esau. There seems to have been a little bit of a desire of, what do you think, Esau's going to get my daughter? Forget it. That much. Rather than, do you think my daughter's going to land up with an Esau? Forget it. There's a slight difference of emphasis, and that's what he's being criticized for. If it's truly 100% that you're worried about your daughter and you don't want her to marry a person like Esau, that's fine. That's acceptable. Nothing wrong with that. But the Torah detects in Yaakov's tone a deep subconscious pleasure in denying dinner to Esau. And that's not acceptable. That's not acceptable. The motive isn't acceptable. The Bali Musa put it a little differently. They say, yes, it's correct. Yaakov was right to lock dinner away in a cupboard, in a box. It's fine, that's okay, the right thing to do. And for you parents of daughters, sometimes you might have to do the same thing. Nothing wrong with it. Lock her up in a box. But you knock the nails in too hard. That's the way the Bali Musa said. You took too much pleasure in knocking the nails in. But there was an element of Esau's not going to get his hands on her. And that's what he's being criticized for. Lo mas mirei ehu chesed. We have to be very careful not to withhold from our friends chesed. And not to forget that no matter how critical we are of re'enu, of our brothers, our friends, those that hold by the same Torah, by the same mitzvah, to remember at the end of the day, they're our friends, they're our brothers, they're more like us than anybody else's. And I have to realize that on the one hand we've spoken about the difference between Jews and Gentiles. The same applies within the Frum world. You've got Hasidim and you've got Misnagdim, and you've got Belzer Hasidim and Lubavitcher Hasidim and Geirer Hasidim, and you've got Misnagdim of this kind and Misnagdim of that kind. All that is fine and very well. But at the end of the day there needs to be an understanding that another Jew who keeps Torah and mitzvahs with his own style, with his own emphasis, but at the end of the day, he's your brother. He's much closer to you than somebody who's right outside of that framework. These are things one must retain the perspective. Sometimes brothers argue a lot. Sometimes brothers have a fight. And it can be a really bitter fight. The kind of fight the two strangers will never have. They can only have it because they're brothers. and they remember that they're brothers, and they know that they're brothers, and they know that in a time of trouble they depend on one another. And that's something we've got to remember too. That the closer we are to one another, whether it's a Shomer Mitzvahs or it's as Jews in general, the closer we are to one another, the more at the end of the day we rely on one another. And while we're entitled and expected to be critical of the way we behave with one another, never are we allowed to regard one of our souls as being alien, as being foreign. That much. There were, during the time of the war, in the early years of the war, there were communities, including elements of the South African Jewish community, and certainly Zionists in Israel, that opposed any possibility of bringing Eastern European Jews into the country, because they were foreign, they would be an embarrassment. That kind of, they don't speak English, they dress differently, it would be an embarrassment. There was a body of English and German Jews in South Africa, and in many other countries, and in Israel, that actually tried not to have refugees from Eastern Europe coming into this country because they thought it would be an embarrassment. They felt closer to their non-Jewish counterparts than they did to their Jewish Eastern European brothers. That was something that existed at that time. One has to be aware of it. And Chas v'Shalom, there should never ever be such a feeling again. You can have a person, a Jew, who's distant, who doesn't keep anything, whatever. He is a much closer relative to the Yidden Meir Sha'orim, who walks around with his shtreimel and his beard and his long kapote and his tzitzitah. They're much closer to one another than either of them are to any non-Jew. The other medrash is a bit further down. Omer Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni. That's about 10 lines further down. Omer Rabbi Yonason. Kol ha'ise mitzvah achas v'ilom hazeh. This goes on the posuk Yilaftoi orchis darkon. That the ways of their lives are wrapped around them. So it says Shmuel bar Nachmeni in the name of Rabbi Yonason, Kol ha'ise mitzvah achas v'ilom hazeh. Anybody who does even a single mitzvah in this world, mekad mesoi v'hileches lefonav v'ilom habo. That mitzvah goes ahead of him and walks in front of him into olam habo. Shneim, as it says, v'holach lefonecho tzidkecho. The pasuk that says, your righteousness will walk before you. It doesn't come after you, it walks before you. V'chol ha'isa aveiro achas v'olam hazeh. If one does an aveiro, melachas tzoi v'hileches lefonav l'yom hadin. It cleaves to him, sticks with him, and walks before him into yom hadin, into the day of judgment. This is a well-known chazal that's often quoted. The point that I want to examine briefly here is, what is this mekadmaso? What's so relevant that it walks in front of you? A person does a mitzvah, the mitzvah walks in front of you in olam haba. Let it walk next to you. Let it be part of you. Let it walk behind you. What's this walking in front of you? You do an avero, the avero walks in front of you. And this chazal is also very important in the way we understand things, and relates back to various things that I've said in the ladies' shiur on Shabbos morning over the past few weeks. And that is the way we present things and the way we present people. That a tremendous amount of the appreciation of an object or of an idea or of a person depends on the preparation for that appreciation. Tremendous amount. We've often talked about it. If I were to take you to a concert and tell you nothing about it before, come, let's go to a concert. We get in the car and we go. What's playing? Don't know what's playing. Let's go and see. We'll go in here. So you go, you listen to music. It's very nice. Who played it? Don't know. But if I take you before, a month before, and I say, you know, I've gone to a great deal of effort to get 2 tickets for a very special concert, and I want to explain to you why it's so special. We're going to listen to music that was written by Mozart or whoever. And I want you to understand why Mozart was so special. And I give you a bit of background as to the nature of his music and the way he worked and how he wrote things. And we're going to hear very special musicians. And I give you the background as to who they are And one doesn't hear them very often. They come from overseas. One doesn't have the opportunity very often. And they're here, and this is the only concert, and it's packed. Nobody can get tickets. I managed to get 2 tickets. And I'll pick you up half an hour before, and we'll go, and we'll sit, and we'll listen to the concert. A completely different appreciation of the music. Might be exactly the same music, but it's a completely different appreciation of the music. Why? The music's the same. I've prepared you for it. And it doesn't even matter if the preparation was true or not. As long as you don't know enough to catch me out. It doesn't, even if it wasn't Mozart, even if it was Bach, and I told you it was Mozart, that will also do fine. And even if it was my own composition, not even Mozart's or Bach's or anybody else, it's my music, but I didn't tell you, I told you it was Mozart, you would still appreciate it very nicely. And even if it wasn't an overseas artist, it was just some local people that they got from the School of Music here, some of their least talented players, you would still find it very enjoyable. We have expectations, and the expectations play a very important part in our perception of the true thing. If we have no expectation, then we rely totally on our expertise. So if we're real experts in music, then without expectations we'll be able to listen to it and decide whether it was good or bad and how good or bad it was. But if we're not real experts, and sometimes even when we are real experts, our perception of the experience is enormously colored by what we expect it to be. And the same applies with ideas. I told the ladies, I think, of a Rosh Hashiva sometimes, who say, a wonderful person, a big time in Tottenham. And he has a wonderful skill of making people very excited about the most simple things. And the most wonderful skill, if he hasn't prepared anything to say, and all he can say is, you know, you can imagine this is one of the stories that goes around about him. That he's the kind of person that could come along and he would say to you, okay, I'm going to give a drosha. And then he'll talk a little bit and he'll tell you and he'll say, now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm about to tell you something that nobody has ever understood before, that nobody has ever heard properly before. I want you to listen very, very carefully. This is a principle in life that is so true you can't believe it. Listen carefully what I'm going to tell you. The first letter of the alphabet is I. And the second letter is this. And you hear a stunning silence. He has that ability to prepare you for what he's saying in a way that enables you to listen to it with a sense of importance that makes sure you try to do it. There are not many people that do that. But he regards what he's going to say, however trivial it might appear, to be important enough to have his audience properly prepared. So when one introduces a concept, one can say it casually, you can just throw it out, and people don't even realize what you're saying. The experts will, but how many experts are there? Well, you can prepare your audience for it and tell them, I'm about to say something very special. I'm about to say a chiddush which you haven't heard before. Now listen carefully. This is what I'm about to say. And then you say it. We are. They hear about us. We're presented. We're introduced to them. Then we're called in. By the time we're called in, they know all about us already. There's nothing more we have to say or nothing more we have to do. That's the value of a mitzvah. That's what we need to think about when we're doing a mitzvah. This mitzvah is going to talk for us. This mitzvah is going to introduce us. This mitzvah is going to tell them who we really are. And that's when we put our hearts into a mitzvah. And that's when we put a dimension into a mitzvah that nobody will ever know about. That's when we put a thought into a mitzvah that nobody will ever know about. When we put a little bit of extra effort into a mitzvah that nobody will ever know about. That's the beautiful medrash that we did in the Lady Shu recently, where had Reuven known that it was going to be written in the Torah, that, and remember the story with Yosef, and Reuven's idea was that they would put Yosef into the pit. It was his idea, they wanted to kill him. And he said, no, let's put Yosef into the pit. And his idea was, we'll come back later and I'll pull him out of the pit. By the time Reuven came out, already Yosef had been sold. And Chazal said, had Reuven realized that whole thing would have been reported in the Torah, he would have carried Yosef on his shoulders to his father. He wouldn't have taken such a risk. Had Boaz known that it would be said in the Megillah that he gave Ruth a small little meal, and there was good reason why he did it, then he would never have done it had he known that that was going to be written. We don't function the same when we're in the public limelight as we do when we're not. When a person suddenly realizes he's being watched, everything changes. His posture changes, his movements change, his speech changes, his action, everything changes, all of a sudden. Why? You see people being televised. It's hilarious. sitting and they relax and everything, and they tell them that the moment they realize the candles are going, they get a completely different person. What's the difference? What's the difference? What's changed? You're visible now. Had Reuven realized he was visible, had Boaz realized he was visible, even they would have acted differently. Tzaddikim of that level are still affected by the knowledge that they're being watched. They still, you get the best out of them when they're being watched, not when they're on their own. And the Midrash goes on to say, nowadays who writes? There's no Novi to write it down. Who writes? Our mitzvahs and our veiros, they get written down. And you are Novi, write it down. It comes to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what we need to realize. But the way we do that mitzvah, we think it's private. We think, at the best, people can only see the action. But the thought that goes into it, the extra mitzvahs nefesh to really do it nicely, nobody's going to know the difference. So let's get away with the quickest thing we can. It doesn't work. That's what's going to introduce us. When we come to Olam HaEmes, that tells the Ribbono Shel Olam who we really are. If those deeds, those actions, those thoughts, those feelings that we've had, the way we've done them, that tells the Ribbono Shel Olam who we really are. Imagine one Shmonesa, all these mitzvahs will come. It'll take a long time before we let in. We wait outside while all these mitzvahs are going in. Just think of all the Shmonesas we've said in a lifetime. They'll all go in one by one. Each Shmonesa will go in. Each Shema will go in. Each benching will go in. And we'll tell the Ribbono Shel Olam what kind of a person he is, this guy. What he was thinking about when he said me. How much kavona he used when he said me. Had mind when he said me. Each one by one, will go in. By the time we come in, the Ribbono Shel Olam will know our subconscious inside out already. Even if he didn't, so to say, watch us all through our lifetime. It all gets played out before the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's this Chazal here, V'holach l'ponecho tzidkecho. Our tzidkus goes in front of us, it goes before us. Our tzidkus, or our averus chas v'sholom, go before us, and they represent the introduction process in the context of which we come before the Ribbono Shel Olam afterwards, and we try to present ourselves. Chapter 7. Eve goes on attacking the philosophy and the Pharisees. And he says, a person works, he toils on. He may sochir yomov, and his days are like the days of a sochir. But ke'eved yishar. Still, like a slave, he craves for the uchesochir yekaveh po'olo, and like a paid hand, a worker, he waits for the end of his work. The Malbim explains that there are two types of work. There's an eved is a salaried person. A person who earns a salary is an eved, before it. Or a slave, also, they're all the same thing. Because a salaried person has sold his time. That's a slave, that's an eved, he hasn't got freedom. We don't feel that way. We feel quite comfortable being salaried people, and the only reason we do is because we don't realize that we've sold our time. We think our time is our own. And we think we're free to take it easy a little bit during the day, and we think we're free to make private telephone calls during the day, and that's why we don't feel like slaves, because we're not honest. But if we were really honest, we would feel like slaves. One sold that time, from that time of the day till that time of the day. Slave, not your time. That's abdus. And that's why Jews have generally tried not to seek employment. Jews have generally tried to be their own balabatim, even at much lower salaries, much lower income. Again, this is a new tendency in the world today, that Jews prefer higher income as salaried people rather than lower income as their own balabatim. Not a Jewish phenomenon there. Normally we value, the Chazal say, that we value our own freedom 9 times as much as a salary. In other words, if a person working on his own could earn 5,000 rand a month, if he's thinking like a true Jewish person, then he would not take a job unless he was being paid 45,000 rand. Wouldn't pay him. His freedom is worth more to him than anything less than 9 times the salary he could be getting. It's important for freedom. the ability to take off time to go and hear a shir. Important to be able to take off time, and if he wants to, just to have that freedom to do what you want with your own time. We don't feel it that way for two reasons. The one is, even when we're working for a salary, we don't have that commitment. We don't realize what that means. But what it means, a commitment to a salary, Chazal say, that if the poel is up in the tree chopping wood, he doesn't have to bench, he doesn't have to say Kriya Shema, just the first sentence of Kriya Shema, he can't even stop for davening. You don't allow his time belongs to his balabos. His governing is a problem, certainly his learning is a problem, his time belongs to his balabos, absolutely, every minute of that time belongs to his balabos. If we would really recognize that obligation, we would feel very uncomfortable earning salaries. And we would try and get out of it, even at much lower salaries. But we don't feel so uncomfortable because it's accepted practice that even though I'm being paid for my time, I can do what I want, which isn't true. And the other reason that we don't take it seriously, is that we don't value freedom enough. We say to ourselves, and if I was my own balabos, what would the difference be? I've still got to work hard. I can't afford to take off time in any case. I've still got my bond to pay. I've still got my overdraft to worry about. What's the difference going to be? It's not as if I can use the freedom. We don't value freedom enough. We don't value spare time enough. We don't value the opportunity to do that. And sometimes when a person's salaried, he thinks to himself, if only I was my own balabos, I would take a day off a week, I would sit and learn, spend more time with the family. But yeah, what can I do? I'm an employee. Comes the day he becomes his own balabos, and he works even harder than he works as an employee. We don't actually know how to use our time properly, how to master our time. But ideally, we should understand that there are these two different types of employment. An eved, what does he crave for? When you say to the eved, to the employee, you walk up to him in the middle of the day and you say, what are you waiting for? I'm waiting for 5 o'clock. Why 5 o'clock? Work's over, 5 o'clock I go home. That's what he's waiting for. If you say to a sochir is a laborer who's paid for the job. He's not paid for the time. You hire him to paint the room. When he's painted the room, you'll pay him. That's what you don't pay him on a daily basis. If you'll say to him, what are you waiting for? He'll say, I'm waiting to finish the job. Because as soon as I finish the job, I get paid. It's a different mentality. The sochir tries to finish the job as quickly as possible, and the poel tries to pass the time as quickly as possible. Different philosophy. And that's why one should employ sechirim, one shouldn't employ avodim. One should employ people that one is paying for the job if possible, rather than paying for the time. If a person's paid for the job, he wants to finish the job. If he's paid for the time, all he wants is for the day to finish. And it's a completely different technique. Now, Eov is claiming that either way, however you want to look at life, life can also be looked in one of those two ways. Has Hashem given each one of us a specific job, and when the job is over, we die? Or has Hashem given us a specific allotment of time, and when the time is over, we die? It's one of the two. And says Eov, Kein honchalti li yarcheshov, so I too have inherited for myself months of emptiness, veleilos omo minuli, and nights of toil, of hard work, of suffering, have been given to me. Im shochavti v'amarti mosai okum umidad orev. When I lie down, it's gone. V'sovati nidudim ade noshef. And I'm full of moving backwards and forwards until the morning. Lovash besori rimo v'gush ofer. My flesh has become full of decay and dust. Oyri roga vayimoyes, my skin is splitting and it's become disgusting. Yomai kalu mine orig vayichlu be'efes tikvo. My days are going as quickly as the weaver's shuttle, the English translates it, which is correct. And they're just going without any kind of sense of hope. In other words, it makes no difference whether I'm looking at it from the point of view of a man who's been given an allotted period of time, I just wait for that time to go, I want to die. Or if I've been given a job to do, I trust that the job has been done already. I want to die. And that, says Eov, makes a mockery out of your claim, Eliphaz. Because if Hashem has got work for me to do, more enosh kisa gadlenu, what is man that you should uplift him? The chisoshis elov libecho, that you should apply your mind to him. That you should watch him continuously, that every minute you should be checking him. In other words, Eiyub is now saying, I regard human beings as too insignificant for God's attention. This is an argument that has been put forward by atheists for centuries. Yeah, believe in God, that's fine, but God is too important and we are too insignificant for us to believe that God watches us. That's a diminishment of God's majesty, is the kind of argument you sometimes hear people saying. Now, I spoke on Shabbos and previously about the difference between bigness and smallness in perceptions. When you look at something, are you looking at it with a big eye or with a small eye? And I gave you the example that if one responds to the shir, I don't know how many people there are here this evening, say there's 60 people here this evening, if one responds to this and says, gee, isn't that amazing? 60 people came on a Monday night, on the night time, late, they left their homes, they've come, isn't that incredible? That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is only 60 people. Sefer Eiyub. This understanding of Sefer Eiyub of the book, of the only book of the Tanakh that really examines the meaning of existence. Only 60 people. Which is looking at it bigger and which is looking at it smaller? The second way shows greater importance of the book of Eiyub than the first way. If you come along and say, gee, 60 people actually came. That means we're saying the people are very big. Very important people. 60 of them managed to find the time to come. That's amazing. To come just to listen to little ears. Who would have thought that you would have got 60 people to come and listen to ears? Now that's the way we normally look at it. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that's the way we normally look at it. The other way is only 60 people. Little people. What else? Have they got anything more important to do than to learn ears? What else can there be? What's more important than to learn ears? Two different perceptions. One regards the people as big and the Torah is small, and the other regards the Torah is big and the people is small. Now we've got exactly the same perceptions with Hashem. This great Hashem, wonderful big Hashem, he's not going to bother himself with us little people. That's the one perception. And the other perception is human beings. How are human beings? The Ribbono Shel Olam created us. Do you think he's just going to abandon us, not take notice of us? That's how great we are. Two different perceptions. Are we going to be man-centered or God-centered? And in many ways, the Torah is man-centered, not God-centered. We've often discussed about the difference between Kabbalah and Halacha, between mysticism and Halacha. And we've said that mysticism is man's view of God. Halacha is God's view of man. When we're looking at mysticism, we talk about the Gadlus HaBoreh, the greatness of the Ribbono Shel Olam. When we look at Halacha, we look at the greatness of the human being. The ability of the human being to master the world, al pi halacha, and to master God's reasoning, that's the greatness of the human being. Two different perspectives, both are right. But at any given time, you've got to take one perspective. And Eiyub chooses here to take a perspective of saying, if you ask me, how can I do that to Hashem to say that he's abandoned the process to an outside force, which is what Eiyub first argued, that there's some kind of program, and Hashem has programmed the world, and he's left it alone. That's a diminishment of God. That's what Eliphaz is accusing him of saying. What are you suggesting? That God's abandoned the caring of the world to a program? Yes, says Eiyub. Because I think God's too busy to worry about us. He's got bigger things to worry about. Who are we? And for that, Chazal criticized him. But this is, Eiyub isn't worried about the criticism. That's one of the lovely things about Eiyub. He's going to argue. He's going to throw it all out, as we learned last week already. He's not worried. He's going to put it all on the table to be argued. And this is an argument he's suggesting. At the end of it, Eiyub comes right. So all the criticisms of Chazal are not criticisms against Eiyub, the man. Because Eiyub the man is a tzaddik and Eiyub the man comes out fine at the end. They're criticisms against statements made by Eiyub at certain points along the argument. And Chazal wants us to know that those statements are unacceptable. As unacceptable as they are, Eiyub puts them on the table. Let's try it, says Eiyub. You want to know why I say God has abandoned us? Not because I think God is too small to handle us. I just think we're not important enough. And that's an unacceptable argument. We are important enough. And that's one of the axioms that Eiyub has not yet accepted, that there is a centrality to the world of the human being, that the Ribbono Shel Olam has chosen to put the human being in the world and in the center of the world and to revolve everything around that human being. But that's an argument that Eiyub will develop later on. But meanwhile, next time we'll just tie this parak up and move on to build that argument, the second of the friends, who launches into a second attack on Eiyub on a completely different plane. Unfortunately, there won't be a shear for the rest of the month of May. So the next year of shear, if you'll diarize, that will be the first Monday in June in this session.